We interview afterwards. She says, I don't know why I came up. I have crippling social anxiety, but I wanted to give it a shot. And she said, she said she'd been more free than she'd ever been before and that she wanted to explore improv. So I think there is something to it in that you're getting rid of the part of the brain that's saying, you can't do this, you're going to look stupid, you're going to look silly. All that kind of stuff just kind of floats away and they're just free up there. And it's really beautiful to watch. When they're in the zone, it's when I see Colin and we call them hipprovisers, the people who volunteered on stage that are improvising while hypnotized. When they're in the zone, it's like, it's magical on stage. It truly is. It sounds cheesy, but it is beautiful because you're seeing somebody on stage who doesn't have improv background, no acting experience. They're in front of 1,000 people and they're completely free. It's childlike and beautiful to watch.
So, like, how do you know if someone is hypnotizable or not?
Yeah, so I start with 20 volunteers, and approximately 20% of the population are going to be good subjects, hypnotic subjects for a stage hypnosis show. So from there, I whittle it down to the best 4 or 5, and then Colin comes out and then improvises with them. And I'm basing it on physiological feedback. So I'm looking for changes in rate and location of respiration. So breathing changes, skin color changes, you go light to dark, dark to light, vasodilation, the capillaries in the eyes become engorged, slow, sluggish movement, muted voice, mask-like facial expression. So they have a hypnotic mask. So they look like they have a poker face. So I'm looking for all of these physiological signs or indicators. And if I see them, then I'll keep the people on stage that are hypnotized. And then if I don't, then I'll just ask them to leave. And it's kind of like what poker players are looking for when they're trying to get a read, like an unconscious read on or a tell on their opponent. It's same kind of thing. So I'm watching all of them very closely and then determining who's going to be the best candidates.
How long does this take? Do you think I'd be hypnotizably over Zoom?
It takes about five to 10 minutes roughly. And it's very hard to determine until I'm in front of the person. And well, hypnosis is context driven too, because they've come up on stage, they've decided they want to be hypnotized. So a lot of the really good subjects, believe it or not, hypnotic subjects are already primed. So they already start to exhibit these trance indicators. So they start to look like their eyes start to defocus. They start to exhibit mask-like facial expression. They start to look kind of tranced out when they come up on stage. So they're already kind of primed. And if you pay attention, you can even notice when you talk to people, you can see when people start to go into trances because their eyes defocus. They start looking, they're not really looking at you. They're looking kind of through you and they look like they're not paying attention. That's kind of what I'm looking for when I'm looking for a good subject on stage, somebody who's not paying attention. So, I'm saying this obviously tongue in cheek, but you kind of get a sense of it, yeah. Right? Sort of tell when people start to look like they're in another place.
Interesting. Colin, have you ever been hypnotized by?
People keep pushing us to do it. So Asad hypnotized me and it's incredibly relaxing. And, part of the fun of this show, I'm going to say fun. I don't know if that's the right word, but we have these two art forms that people are always doubting. All through the Whose Line years, I would have people say, I saw you reading cue cards. I was like, really? Okay. Then transcribe that scene, read it back and see if it makes any sense whatsoever. And it's the same with hypnosis. People, for whatever reason, just have a high level of skepticism. And that's what's great about this show, especially for family members or people who know the subjects. They are certainly seeing that it truly is something that works. And I hope it dispels a lot of the sort of the myths about hypnotism. Everything you see on movies and television tend not to be truly connected to the world. These people aren't, they haven't lost who they are. They're still the same people. They're aware the entire time. They just don't have that part of the of their brain that says you can't do this, you're going to embarrass yourself. They just have complete freedom.
It's like people think someone's going to pull out a queen of hearts and something crazy is going to happen there.
We definitely are on the fun light side of the hypnosis, not on the clinical application. Let's put it that way.
I will say the people who are brought up are treated very safely. Assad is very careful with them, making sure that they're in a safe spot and that everything is good. When I'm improvising, I'm trying to make sure that as I would treat any improviser. So, we're not making fun of them, making them cluck like chickens or bark like dogs or doing anything embarrassing, have them take off their clothes. They're just your basic improv troupe that we're having fun with.
The old version, because there's people who are listening to this and have seen the, bark like a dog, cluck like a chicken hypnosis shows. That's not this show. For the crescendo of the show, I'll give you an example. Colin is a detective solving a case. He gets the information from the audience about what the case is about. He improvises the case completely on stage, and then one of the volunteers plays all the different characters that Colin comes into contact with while solving the case. So he might come into a contact with a femme fatale. He may come into contact with the chief of police, and they're changing and morphing into the different characters. So it's very much elevated. When we performed off Broadway, we were covered by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time Out, New Yorker, and we were actually nominated by the off, excuse me, we're nominated by the Off Broadway Alliance Awards. For mo most unique theatrical experience. So it's very much theater.
I read those articles, and I also found some like personal experiences that people were posting online and stuff. And it just really seemed like if someone wasn't uncomfortable, they were able to sit back down and eventually be guided out of the hypnotic state if they didn't want to be there.
Yeah, you get stuck in hypnosis. So that's one thing a lot of people talk about is, oh, what would happen if, the hypnotist dropped dead, what mid show, right?
That would be
And
great.
they've done they've it was Dr. Orney that ran the experiments, and I believe it was Harvard. They hypnotized first year psychology students, turned off all the lights, left the lecture hall, 5 to 15 minutes, all of them would come out of the hypnosis, and that experiment's been replicated many times. You're not asleep when you're hypnotized, although the Greek god of sleep, fun fact, is named Hypnos, I should say. But you're not asleep when you're hypnotized. You're aware of what's going on. You're hearing the sound of my voice at all times. Physiologically, you look asleep, so because your body's really relaxed, but you are not asleep. So you're aware of what's happening at all times. You can't be made to do anything that you don't want to do when you're hypnotized. You can be made to do things that you normally wouldn't do. So that's the distinction for when it comes to stage hypnosis. And when people come up on stage, they have already given tacit permission. They are there to experience the hypnosis. And then they really do have these tremendous experiences. The best way to describe hypnosis would be watching a movie, getting so caught up in what you're watching that you're moved to a physiological response. So that would be the best way to describe a hypnotic trance state. So you watch a horror movie, you get caught up, your palms start to sweat, your heart starts to race. Logically, you know what you're watching on the big screen is not real, but for that moment in time, during that scary scene, you think it's really real. Or you watch a tearjerker and you start to cry. Logically, you know that the person who's on the big screen's not actually dying. It's not Leonardo DiCaprio going down with the ship. It's actually he's a excuse me. It's not Jack going down. It's Leonardo DiCaprio who's acting, and he's dating models in Hollywood, making millions of dollars, right? So he's doing just fine. But for that moment in time, you're really, really, really so dialed in that you get that emotional response. So because you're so fully immersed in the movie. And that's the best way to describe what occurs up on stage when somebody's hypnotized.
Because he could have fit on that door
Could have easily.
easily.
Just push her off, get on.
Or that, like, But yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So kind of veering away, I'm curious if you guys have any tips for someone maybe wanting to get into improv, going like, 'cause this is a totally different show, maybe taking a different approach, or would you want them to start out, just doing typical improv or.
I say to, first of all, if you're looking to do improv as a career, I always say, if there's anything else you love, do that instead. It's great. We were, everyone on Whose Line, incredibly fortunate that the show came from Britain to showcase the one thing we do well. But I also say, to everyone, take improv classes. It is a great life skill to have, to learn how to listen to people, to learn how not to prejudge situations. And if you decide to do it as a profession, just keep doing it. And so many people who have started doing that have branched off into coming up with different ways of doing improv. Like Assad coming up with this particular brand. People, I have a friend who he started Dungeons and Dragons improv shows, where the characters from Dungeons and Dragons, and there's a dungeon master who sort of guides them through an improv adventure. Then there's like one act plays that people have improvised based on a certain playwright, like Shakespeare or Chekhov. So you can do so much with improv. Not only on stage, but in life. So I always encourage people to do it. It's a great skill.
What is the industry like the performance industry or touring or even the comedy?
It's horrible. There's a lot of people out there, incredibly talented people who, either can't get a break. And there's a lot of talented people who are working right now, showing. We're lucky we've come up with this sort of, I don't think there's any other improv hypnosis shows out there, so good on us. You have to find your place in there, but it's a hard business. It's a hard business because, you can't show your resume and go, here's what I can do. I can build a house in 3 days. It's like, here, I make up stuff. It's pretty hard to find a job that fits. And you're based on your appearance a lot of the time. I know so many incredibly talented people who just haven't had that break yet. But when you're in this business, it's a business of dreams, and everything can change overnight. You can go from, Wayne Brady was a Tigger at Disney World, and then he got Whose Line. I don't think he went back to Tigger. It's worked out nicely for him.
Yeah. Crazy. How do you both see high prov, hip prov?
Oh man. Well, yeah, Assad has viciously berated people for less than that.
do you both see hip prov moving forward in the future? Do you think you'll add changes or maybe add people?
So I will tell you that we just sold Hiprov to a major Canadian streamer in Canada. We've licensed the show there. We shot a special, and now Canadian viewers can watch the show. I think the next step is to have it streaming in the United States. So that would be the next step, and then global, because we'd love to bring Hiprov to the masses.
Yeah, but also it would be great if we could, every country have a hip-prov with a local improviser, a local hypnotist, speaking in their own language, doing whatever they do, and while we rake in the money. That's my dream. Assad, he's very, he's noble, and he has better, he wants to make mankind better. I just want to add an addition to my house.
Are you guys doing anything in addition to hip hop right now, or is that like your both main focus right now?
I have an album out with Rufus Wainwright. It's entitled An Exploration of Hypnotic Sound. It actually features John Hilson, who is an incredible musician who plays improvised music with us throughout the show. He's our musical director, incredible keyboardist. So Definitely someone to watch as well. His name is again John Hilson. He's part of the album.
Yeah, I do stuff. I'm doing it. There's a TV show called Murdoch Mysteries. I think it's sometimes it's. I'm a semi-regular as a serial killer, so I think I may be coming back for a bit, and then yeah, something always pops. I was out for my mother's 90th birthday in Vancouver. Ended up doing a horror movie for a couple of days in the interior of BC, which was a lot of fun.
That's
Spoiler
exciting.
alert, I didn't make it.
No.
Yeah.
So first you were a serial killer.
And then I got my
Then,
comeuppance in another project.
yeah, and then you got serial killed. That's
Yeah. That's karma.
is there anything else you guys wanna say to our audience before we sign off?
Sure. So I think the show is fast-paced. Hip-hop is fast-paced. It's action-packed, high energy, and hilarious because we've got Colin Mochrie from Whose Line Is It Anyway improvising with people he's never met before who are hypnotized.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's family friendly. You have to be 18 or over to be hypnotized, but we have kids come to the show. They really enjoy it. They love seeing adults be goofy.
So the kids can't be hypnotized.
We just asked for 18 and up because of the.
Apparently, there's laws. Oh well. So my idea of like 12-year-old butlers is no longer relevant.
It's been super great chatting with you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been really great. All right. Well, this has been Aubrey on a Bench with Colin Mochrie and Asad Meki. Thank you guys again so much.
Thank you.
But yeah, your show, Hip-Rof, will be at Carnegie at Homestead, I believe. Or,
Yeah, I believe
yeah,
so.
I believe so. On November 9th.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Right, so today our guest is Simona Körner. I was going to ask you to teach me how to pronounce your name correctly.
You met it pretty well.
Okay. So we met on the first day of grad school, and we became fast friends. And I wanted to invite Simona because we met up this past weekend in Princeton at a conference called Fantasies of the People, and Nick was also there. And because of that opportunity of you coming to this country, Simona and Nick came from Germany. I thought it would be really nice to be able to spend some time together, and then for Simona to be able to share their performance practice and the work they've been doing recently with field recordings with you all. One of the things that I feel really connected with you about with your practice is how research-based it is. And with research, it expands beyond reading. Right? And it's a kind of research that is about connecting with people. It's very embodied. And in your performance work, you talk about this, right? And you enact it. And I wanted you to come and be able to share that with us.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah.
So interesting because maybe I just We already talked about that in the car a bit, that I have the feeling I was like so in a kind of way anxious to come here and talk about my practice because so much changed in the last weeks, like politically, and not just because of like telling or speaking out about political things, but also because I have the feeling my artistic practice needs to necessarily change through that, or I have to like regain it, and like it's like broken apart in pieces, and now I have to like somehow pick them up again and see how to deal with them, or with the forms which are somehow not so pliable anymore. At some points, I mean, at other points, yes. But so I'm really curious about speaking with you today, and also a bit like loaded. That's what I wanted to say. So maybe I brought some materials. Like I thought it would be nice, because I see my artistic practice very much implicated in like the practice of many others in your practice. That's why we maybe found us the first day, but also like historically embedded like in a network at some point. I brought like a recording of Louis Schulte-Zucchai, from whom you maybe already heard like the presentation, the video, I don't know. I shared a text, a video of Louis, who was a scholar at my, like who was a visiting artist scholar at my university in Nuremberg, ADBK Nuremberg, and from whom I learned like a lot about sound and perception. And I found it interesting already in our entering round now, like that it's even not so clear what to talk about when we talk about sound, that it like so fast goes to music, that it somehow draws back to the self. You came with recording techniques, and this somehow already reveals so much about the horizon one grew up in, without even talking about identity. You don't need to talk about where one specifically comes from, and it tells a lot about class, gender, implicatedness when you talk about how you listen or how you sound and how you perceive this. So Louis, I brought two texts, one by Nisha Ramaya, I don't know how to pronounce her name, maybe you
can help. Nisha Ramaya,
which is one of my favorite poets at the moment, who writes in this book, which is called States of the Body Produced by Love, through reoriginating herself again and again in different forms of narration, and through the Sanskrit language as a very sounding language, as language which takes like sound in itself very serious, or like which is implicated much more than like in European or Western languages, where you do not think a lot about like how a word is like in and of itself perceived through its sound. And here we have like a language which I cannot speak, but which she tries to mediate through, which she taught she herself in through reading a colonial book about it, like a colonial lexicon, and she tries to deal with that abstraction of her own life, with that violence, her relation to gain that language as a sound practice. And I
also like,
sure, please, you can watch through everything of this. I brought Simone Weil, the Iliad or the Poem of Force. These two things will also be very present in the text I read, and maybe it's a good, like, giving a short introduction to it is a good thing, because it's like, then you maybe can deal better with a very abstract text I wrote. Simone Weil was an organized anti-fascist and Christian mystic, which is like a crazy combination, in like during the Nazi regime in France. And she was like, this text she wrote in 1940, and shortly after the fall of France. So it's really directly connecting with fascism, with the Nazi regime. And she's looking at the Iliad as like the Greece urmythos, like as the epic, also as one urmythos of like our lives. And she goes through force as like actually the hero or the main protagonist, instead of like Iliad or Homer or whoever, is in all this history embedded, and she really tries to make clear how force operates on our lives, and like through a very layered history. And I thought this is like also connecting to sound a lot, because we with sound we deal like with energy and with like matter moving, stuff like that. Yeah. I brought some stuff from different places, from which also the sounds I will share with you, field recordings, originated, so that you maybe also have like a bit of a material relation to the places. This is like from my forest at the hinterland. I don't know if we burn it because it's, but you can like give it around and smell a bit of it.
What is it?
It's the resin from
resin
a tree.
From, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Fichte. Sorry, my English. I don't know. Yeah. And I also brought like two microphones, which a partner of mine, like collaborator, very close friend, partner, developed, which are electromagnetic microphones, with which I did also record a lot, and with which we can play a bit, like listening to our smartphones, for example. Mm. To a bit gain a feeling of different recording techniques and how actually these recording techniques can guide us through space, for example, and make like our perception can be like a technological perception of our body, and guide us in moving through space differently, for example. Yeah, and these are like two things with which you can play them like an instrument, because they're just basically magnets embedded in them.
So one thought we had was to play some of this recording.
Yeah.
So Simona brought this album, which is from Louis Chude Soke, and it's the...
Between music and environment was blurred, especially given that audience responses were expected and incorporated into the soundscape along with a native obsession with echo and reverb. These effects would begin to define the music, particularly that subgenre of reggae that would become central to my listening, my writing, my research, and my recording. This obsession with echo and reverb clearly spoke to some cultural need. There was something there about the joys of exploring technology via sound, but also about redefining and claiming space. Something about self-expansion and duplication. Echo suggested so much about space and the manipulation of time and memory and, of course, sounds. It was because of this shared obsession that I eventually named my overall recording and sonic project Echo Nikusha, the language of space.
The sounds are like from recordings on ground,
right?
Okay. And I don't know if Lewis has spoken in the words on ground. I can imagine it would make sense, but I don't know that.
Right. Okay.
Like the other side of the LP is really like I think then the singular artists and what they have done. For example, a Kurdish person has been there, who has been voicing in the place very much, and I think it's really according to. You can really see that these sound practices differ from different, like, cultural needs. Mm-hmm. Also how these persons, it made sense that this Kurdish person engages with voice in that space, for example, others with, like, a synthesizer. Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, I don't know, like, how much you already talked about the history of recording techniques, for example, but that, like, one of the first uses before, like, there was radio as a transmitting system, and, like, shortly after the microphone was invented, like, one of the first things was in Europe to put, like, telephone lines from the theaters to households. Mm-hmm. So first it was just the king, but King Louis, I think it was, like, Sonnenkönig. And then it was like a thing that it went into many private households, and you could like have an abonnement, pay like 2-3 euros or whatever, to be able to have like a direct connection to the theater. So live transmitting was one of the first questions that immediately arrived with like having microphones on a larger scale.
For listening
to
the film, just the audio of the film.
Just the audio of the theater play, even before film, you know. And one of the interesting effects has been that the audience is like as loudly transmitted as as the theater, because these microphones were not very sensitive. So this must have been, like, there are written things about the experience of listeners of that time who also enjoyed that a lot, actually, because also theater rooms haven't been as silent as ours right now. That came just with Wagner, this audience relation that you should be silent in a theater.
Did the sound come?
People would also gather for doing this together, like when one person had this telephone, like there are like a lot
they
of pictures
pass it around.
And it's like a very female thing also. That they would gather as like 5 to 10 persons and sit there on their couches. I mean, obviously, Bildungsbürgertum, like bourgeois.
Ladies of leisure.
Yeah, exactly. To be on track, what's the new theater piece without going there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. I'm interested in like knowing, you were earlier talking about how sound recording was a part of colonial regimes. I wonder how, like, video and image and documentation for sure, painting, all of that, but sound recording, in what ways do you think? Is that super interesting to hear?
So I also know it just from Lewis, so I'm I can just voice recording, actually. Voice and ritual recording was a lot of like ritual music, rhythm recording. It was just like producing the colonial archive on a large scale. I think this went through all media which have been invented at that time. Lewis also said, like, when he was there, that it was always like when black people started to use, for example, recording techniques, especially with their voice, there was like a huge fear around that, because it was always about the fear of the object striking back, like the colonial subject, which was the object, striking back. And that there's this relation in language that as soon as like colonized people have reached in the colonial frame some state of personhood, white people would try to claim the same state of personhood for a technology, which is insane, because the object relation always changes when the slave or the colonized tries to get out of it. Mm. It's crazy, yeah, how our language shapes around technology and mm-hmm. also how we talk about AI today, something mm-hmm. what Luis says is, mm-hmm. is like so related to basically using the same language we had with slavery.
Yeah.
Slavery mm-hmm. and connected with the same affect and fears and mm-hmm. okay. Just as a brief introduction, I would like I have two prints of this text I'm going to read after the listening session. It's a bit like get yourself in a comfortable position. It's like a bit of a thing. It's field recordings I made in the last year. And especially connecting like infrastructures, which I became interested in, which surround like our lives, through like energy systems, like wind power plants, the electricity transforming thing, like rural education or uneducation, vernacular terms, not very directly, but yeah, I don't know, just like relax. Try to listen with your whole body. We also realized that the sound really activates the room. Try to listen to the room and what the sound does to this room. So we transport like different spaces in this room. strahlen, to beam, radiate, und rauschen, to noise, rush. Begin with sleep. Touch your limbs, feel their skin, but not as yours. Color will come back to the world when you eat, she said. My fingers. I leave out the words now, which shouldn't be in the script, but you can read them. Collapse on me like I love you, but reversed. Sleeping. Through the window, white church tower bright against doom sky. Strahlt in meine Augen. Your eyes hurt from all the scrolling in the night. Thumbs up for someone. Her voice harmonizing with the air siren in Ukraine went viral. And IRL, the same sound sirens simultaneously into my bedroom. German E57, 101 decibels on 30 meters. She singing to the possibility of her immediate death in real time. And IRL, the same sound sirens simultaneously into my bedroom. German E57, 101 decibels on 30 meters, a call for firefighters. Death on the highway. Begin with two sirens. Shh, who has a bird is split horizontally in two halves. Human torso, lower body, bird. She who captivates the eye, haunting voice. She who creates the persuasive act, sweet speech. And we know all things that come to pass upon the fruitful earth begin with his body tied down to the masts of the ship, a phallic gesture indeed, fearing the siren's call. His listening has to be repressive. Protect me from what I want, Lord, or face disorientation, cry. To the point of no return, between Greek islands, sharp cliffs. What happens when a space between two things collapses? The poet wonders, the lover explores, the artist needs death as a limit. But you realize that war wants death as horizon, each to everyone on repeat, try and survive the fucking peace. Begin with sitting in your kitchen. They said the thought of eating came to her when she was tired of tears. White calendar against blue wall, titled Abolition is a Love Language, tells me to begin with March 30, 2018. Great March of Return. Peaceful protests at Gaza border every Friday, 1.5 year, the call for return forms the need to arrive. To be able to move or to move back does not address the past. One can be forcibly displaced, but one cannot be forced to disconnect to what happens when the space between two things collapses. Like I love you. And you can call me Province. My pronouns are a hyper-regional act. She pulsating borders against my skin. Middle class. I feel heterosexual. But when I say heterosexuality, know that I mean the erotics of imbalance. Heterosexuals don't have closets. They just leave their shit strewn about the room, all on display. Hey, I'm speaking to you. Can you address me? A world that seems irreparably out of reach, the poet asks. And you obviously say no, and remember when you read this sentence. We are dispossessed by the knowledge of each other's address, or it's disorienting to know where you are, by Nisha Ramaya. In a meadow, a field polluted, you are polluted, we pollution, and you polluting, looted, looting, a parody of betrayal. Tinnitus. Can you separate sensation from imagination? Begin with a place where time does not hurt, or put your body where your mouth is. Thirst cased down at the edge of her lips. We sleep in a real estate office, spooning and snuggling, simply because it keeps us warm and evacuated from our own fantasy.
Having grown up in this musical household, my dad was a cellist for the Philadelphia Opera Company.
Mm-hmm.
And he would get free tickets for these daytime shows during the week that were part of an education program for the city schools, the public schools in the city, where they would bring kids into the spaces to watch the dress rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew, like, my dad was part of the performance and I could be back in the green room and, like, goofing off
mm-hmm.
after the show, I could also hear all of the performers react to how the kids were behaving in the space,
mm-hmm.
which was so boisterous, and there was talking and there was hooting and hollering and real reactions to funny things that happened, or, like, you know, of course, in tragic opera, there's lots of stuff that happens.
Yeah.
But the kids would react in these, like, visceral, loud, boisterous ways, and the people who were performing in the opera loved it. They were their favorite performances because they were actually getting something from, like, the call and response, right, that we, you know, sort of were listening to at the beginning. Like, they were getting that response that they needed, that energy that they needed.
Yeah.
So there's also something, I don't know, I keep thinking a lot about the vibration being energy
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as well. And like you said, like, this idea that we're supposed to go into theater and just sit and watch and then leave makes it the opposite of what it used to be.
Yeah, completely.
Right.
Completely.
And much more similar, to sitting with our phones. Even movies, when I was a kid, movies and television, I always watched with other people.
Mm-hmm.
We never were watching TV on our own, and now we're always watching TV on our own. But I don't know how, to Alina's point, like, I don't know how you bridge the gap if it's ever, it's always widening.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sad.
Can you specify the gap, or like the gap between audience and performer?
The gap. And I feel like this is true, I'm more a visual artist, but I feel like this is true with visual art as well. Like, people just want to take a picture and move on, or take a picture and post it and move on. And that idea of sitting with
mm-hmm.
something and having that rest that you were talking about, and really waiting for, I don't know, the listener's high or the viewer's high,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, like a runner gets a runner's high, that people just don't take that time. They don't know how to get over that.
Yeah, and it is a question of time. I mean, we had it in the talk of mm-hmm. Danielle.
Danielle Braithwaite Shirley was talking about that in her practice and talking about that in so many exhibition spaces where the expectation is to be entertained, right? Mm-hmm. And so that so many viewers are hoping for this, like, real shift to, like, some kind of feeling. There's, like, expectation. But she creates these interactive installations. I don't know if anyone is familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Danielle Braithwaite Shirley, she works with gaming and creates these interactive gaming spaces that are participatory and involve sound and storytelling.
And she what I also found interesting is that she said a motivation for her to do that was, like, because her audience was so lazy. She mm-hmm. realized that the audience in, like, art spaces is so lazy to perceive, and that you almost do not get them to that point anymore without a certain frame of And I mean this, and this is, I don't want to advocate for like the White Cube Gallery, who has like some very ephemeral photographies in it, and you should like immerse yourself in that. And this is like a very white bougie understanding. But what we already had with that theater practice, for example, but and also like oratory, like storytelling practices, we had a very, very beautiful artist guest person at the Academy of Fine Arts Nuremberg, who was invited by Sylvia Kiambi, and whose name I have to look up again, Ogutu. Ogutu, but I don't know the last name. Made a storytelling performance with us with, like, I think it has been Yoruba techniques of storytelling. And it was so much call and response in that, and you as the audience, you know, you have been comfortable in the room, and Ogutu was telling a story about like a colonial story which then got like at some point a massive great release. And the thing that is happening is that as the audience, you get regularly called. Like, it's like, I think it was like, yeah, yeah. And then the audience answers, yeah, yeah. So that you're with them. Mm-hmm. They're just checking in that you're with them. You don't have to participate in the story, nothing. It's just a checking in. Are you with me? And then you respond, yes, I'm with you. And this, like, I realized, creates a really intense... it immerses you in a very different way than immersion in the overwhelming sense of, like, there's so much in the room that you cannot escape it. That it just totally captivates you. It's not captivating you. You're very free in that and very in the story.
Yeah. And the voice, the added voices become another texture in the space as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's another act of disalienation.
Exactly. It's another act of practice of disalienation. Yeah. For moments. At least. Yeah.
And I think this kind of, I don't know, inability to find joy in concentration or reception or whatever is also kind of helpfully complicating all these discussions around education and bourgeois education and how it's kind of maybe not necessarily the problem to kind of educate children in that way that they should go to the opera and enjoy, but they're also not educated to enjoy it, but kind of educated to sit silently. But there's also parts of this education is also, and I think seriously, about kind of educating them or teaching them or showing them how to enjoy such things, and that it's not necessarily a problem of that, but of the conditions how these kind of education or this kind of enabling of enjoyment is unequally available to different people. But it's kind of, there's often this, and I think I'm definitely also part of it, this kind of boredom or whatever, or like, it's really easy to hate on these kind of modes of education, but I think there are parts of it that are really about finding joy in concentration that are very necessary for people to kind of enable themselves to find joy in things that aren't necessarily like easy consumption of stuff that eventually makes oneself sad.
How much, though, then, is the artist responsible for doing that education? Right, so if we're not getting that education anymore in our youth because technology is changing and we don't need to have that same kind of focus or concentration, then how do we as artists, when we're asking for that from people, how much responsibility do we have to be also educators? Or to have that call and response to get them back in? Or is that just then, device.
Mm-hmm. Does somebody else want to engage in that first?
I think it's a decision that you, as an artist, will have to like make, like develop a practice of making this decision again and again. Because what you're up against is also, like, it's interesting the way that you've been using the word disalienation, because in my head, sound historically has been a source of disalienation, because it comes from, I mean, not comes from a position of power, but, you know, there is somebody speaking in microphone and the rest listens. Mm-hmm. So history of church, polyphonic sounds, like there's an impact that, and the common man is supposed to listen, the one in power is supposed to speak. So like then you as an artist will have to like really dedicate a practice to it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In order to make people listen.
Yeah.
And it always depends on what artist you are and what you want from your practice, but yeah. I think it's very important to understand ourselves as artists always as mediators. Like, we cannot get away from this. This is like also historically the place we are in, because like before art has been established as art. I mean, art has been like a life form, you know, it was like very socially embedded, and art became art through modernity, and in this it has always been the education of the colonized and the education of like the bourgeois. Like, it has been very much part of the of making and forming white subjectivity as the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in all its forms.
When you say art became art, like, what exactly does that
mean? Like, the term art, you know, is not so old. Like, an artist, you have artists and you have artisans also, like, mm-hmm. in the Middle Ages, medieval, blah, blah, blah. But they have always been, like, in charge of something. They have been, like, working for the church. They have been working, like, always in a very dedicated form, you know, for the king. And then the artist has not just painted paintings, but they also did build the interior. Like, they have always been in this more artisan thing.
Craftspeople.
Yeah, craftspeople problem. Yeah. And with modernity, the artist became like a separate autonomous figure. Like, art should become autonomous from this life embeddedment or implication. Because it should be it should be a form of education. This was like the new thing, the new horizon art was directed to, and before it also has been an education, but it has been a very direct education of the senses.
This is rising at the same time as this idea of culture being nationhood.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's the building of the subject of the nation state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, art, A-R-T, as a English word, I believe, would be recent, but I mean, we made art when the first human being of our species put their hand, blood on their hand, on the wall. So,
yeah.
Like, creative expression, I think, or cultural production, I believe, is way more primitive than...
Yeah.
Like, even researching history of, like, sound, and so, like, we were making... Like, we as humans were making sounds on stones.
Exactly.
Before we did... I mean, at the similar time as we did, like, hands on caves.
Yeah.
So, when you say, like, it's way too old...
Yeah, but we, as people who are in here and in this program, are working towards A-R-T, as in the English word that is involved in a capitalist system to some degree. We're not just joyfully making things on the side and then going about our peasant lives.
See, that is exactly what my question to Greg yesterday was.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because I believe we're working, like, we're making art and not A-R-T as in making art for the Western canon art. Like, putting art in the canon of history for the Western civilization. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
I know.
Art is more universal than that. I mean, this sounds very utopian, but I believe in that.
Yeah, probably I would say there comes the question of need in it, because, like, you know, people had a certain need to put their hands on that wall, to leave a trace, to leave, like, they're like very, a lot of needs of origination or stuff like that in these art practices and forms. But yeah, that's why I think a huge question also on that fantasy conference probably is, or leaves us with as artists again and again, is like, is it going to be art what we are producing when we want to like form a liberating practice out of it? Or like, which other form, like, you know, can art stay art? And not in the sense of like, we will do like channeling the creative spirit, which is like the most important thing ever. I think in a human's life, it's super important to have and to establish this and to challenge this also in terms of education, but not in the art as like the Western program of art.